there money in that fund?
Yeah.
Okay. Higher Education Committee will come to order, and I understand Senator Tomasoni is here.
Yeah, I'm right here.
Oh, right there. You know what? I was thinking of you in finance where you sit down there. So I looked for you down there.
You sit here in finance. I've never seen you.
Senator Tomasoni, why don't you start with your bill, and then the staff is also passing out the division supplemental budget proposal so that the audience can have a look at it. Senate File 3300.
Yes, absolutely.
Why do I have two copies of this now?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate File 3300 is the bill relating to the mesothelioma study that the University of Minnesota is intending to conduct, and maybe once and for all find out what is actually going on in regards to the mesothelioma issue on the Iron Range in regards to the taconite miners. As you know, there have been a couple of studies done at different times. I think the last one was in 1998, and for all intents and purposes, it was pretty obvious that none of these studies that were done before were done to completion, and the conclusions they came to appeared to be erroneous. And so after we got the news about 58 more deaths as a result of mesothelioma, a disease which is a lung disease that can take as much as 15 to 30 years to manifest itself, it was pretty obvious that what we needed to do was do a comprehensive study and find out exactly what was going on, where it was coming from, what the causes were, and whether or not we could come up with some type of a solution that would at least give us the indication of how to protect miners from the problem. And ultimately, maybe even find the source and the way to insulate people who work there from the problem. And so the University of Minnesota has graciously volunteered to, well, not really volunteered, but agreed to help us out with this and to actually do a comprehensive study that may take as much as 3 to 5 years and actually try and eliminate all the possibilities that that don't cause the problem and actually find out what does cause the problem. And so what I would just like to do now, Madam Chair, because I think the reason we're in this committee is because of the fact that we are there's a higher ed component to this bill. And so I'd like to have Dean John Finnegan to go ahead and give the University of Minnesota side, and then we'll move to Professor Jeffrey Mandel.
Welcome, Dean Finnegan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Finnegan. I'm a resident of St. Paul, and I am dean of the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. And I think the only thing I would say is that the University of Minnesota's involvement in this is certainly voluntary, although Senator Tomasoni is hard to say no to, and so is true of Representative Rukavina. Our involvement in this study proposal began back in last July when we were approached by Senator Tomasoni, Representative Rukavina, and other members of the Iron Range delegation to help design a study and a partnership with various stakeholders to get to the bottom of the excess number of mesothelioma cases that have been appearing on the Iron Range among taconite workers. And so beginning last August, we put together some preliminary funding provided by President Brunix at the university, provided by the Natural Resources Research Institute at the University of Minnesota Duluth, provided by the Minnesota Department of Health, and also provided by the IRRRB on the Iron Range to begin to craft this proposal and to do some of the preliminary work to get this this project going as we were moving into the main legislative period. So the critical part of this is that beginning last August, we formed a community-based research platform, which we have called the Minnesota Taconite Workers Lung Health Partnership. And this is an organization that brings together all of the key partners and stakeholders from government agencies, from the health sector, from the mining sector, from the union and labor sector, as well as from the university itself, all of the stakeholders in this particular issue, brings them all together in order to assure the kind of community participation that we need in moving this research forward. There have now been two meetings of that lung health partnership. We've created a public website, and we have built what we hope are transparent and open channels of communication as we proceed with the difficult task of performing this research on the range. I'm going to ask my colleague, Dr. Jeffrey Mandel, who is the principal investigator, to briefly go through the four studies that are proposed under Senate File 3300.
Dr. Mandel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Pappas, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Mandel. I'm an occupational physician and a faculty member in the School of Public Health. And I've been coordinating the different components that have led to the proposal that we're discussing today. I just have a couple comments that I think will help sort of put the approach that we're using into context. And if I could just read those over just a couple minutes. First of all, mesothelioma is known to occur as a result of asbestos exposure. It's non-controversial. It's an inimitable result of asbestos exposure at certain levels. The mining industry is known to have several possible sources of asbestos. And in addition, the mesothelioma cases that have been identified by the state cancer surveillance system serve as a signal disease. In other words, when mesothelioma is present, it's very likely that other lung diseases are also present. So consequently, we felt that a more comprehensive approach was needed to really study this issue. We identify some critical issues during the last 6 months or so and that need to be addressed in this investigation. First of all, what workplace factors are related to the 58 mesothelioma cases with a special emphasis on workplace exposures? Are there other diseases occurring in miners as a result of exposure to mining dust? And thirdly, are spouses at risk for diseases as a result of their partners working in the mining industry and as a potential consequence of community dust exposure? So to address these questions, the following types of studies have been designed. The first is what we call a case control study, looking at which factors, particularly workplace exposures, are associated with mesothelioma compared to a group of controls without mesothelioma. And again, exposures would be analyzed in each group, and that forms the basis of the first study. The second study is what we call a mortality or cause of death study of all workers who have been employed in this industry since its inception in the early 1950s and who worked a year or more through a period of time into the 1980s. And in this investigation, we would look at cancer as well as non-cancer causes of death, again, trying to correlate those diseases with exposures, particularly workplace exposures. And lastly, we've proposed a respiratory health screening study of former and current minors and their spouses. And the screening would consist of detailed medical and family histories, physical examinations, lung function tests, and chest x-rays for about 2,000 people. These studies would be complemented by two exposure assessments. One would be a detailed account of workplace exposures, and the other would be measurements of exposures to dusts in the communities on the Iron Range. The exposure work would start immediately and would largely be completed within a year and a half or so. The screening process would start and be completed by the end of this year, and the other two studies would be completed over a three to five-year period of time. Those other studies are complicated by the number of people involved, which is in the range of 70,000 to 80,000 people, and the need to obtain careful work and exposure information on each of those individuals. So it's very time-consuming and labor-intensive. The costs involved include $1.5 million for the case control and cause of death studies, another $1.6 million for the respiratory health screening, and $1.1 million for the workplace exposure assessment, and approximately $800,000 for the community exposure measurements. And with this information, it's our opinion that the that adequate insights will be obtained into the above questions, and appropriate follow-up activities could then be undertaken.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Dean Finnegan or for Dr. Mandel? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, as I was reading the bill, it doesn't make it clear that it's just for a very specific study for the Iron Range. I'm not really reading that in the bill, and you know, and I've often wondered if we have extended this kind of study to other industries. You know, my husband was recently into the doctor and told that he had farmer's lung, and you know, it's something that you get from hay dust, and it can be quite a serious health threat too. But they're not a unionized group, and they don't come in looking for a study in particular on how it might be affecting them as a group, or what could be done or recommended to make sure that they avoid exposure to it. And so I'm looking at this going, well, this study, it isn't saying it's just for the Iron Range, but you're being very specific about what your plans are with the money. And so I'm assuming that even though it isn't cited specifically in the language, that it is intended for only one thing. Is that correct?
Finnegan.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. I'm sure, Senator, that you recall some of the events of earlier in the spring last year that led up to the late release of data concerning the mesothelioma cases, and the resulting fallout from that, of course, then led to the request to involve the university in the leadership role for this particular study. This is certainly outside of what would normally be the case in terms of the involvement of the Health Department, but the Health Department is a critical partner in this scientific research with us. The university in 25 years ago was also involved, engaged in some research along these lines, but for a variety of reasons, the funding for this research, doing it in the way that we've laid out here, which we believe is state-of-the-art, has never really come together all at one time. And we believe this is the best shot we've had in about 25 years for us to get to the bottom of what's causing the mesothelioma cases on the Iron Range. So I would say that as far as other occupational health and safety issues are concerned, certainly the Health Department, the PCA, are deeply involved in those activities and continue to do so.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I know you were talking about workplace exposure and community exposure, and that you would be looking at assessing people individually as well. So will you study their personal lifestyle, habits, and how those could compound the workforce exposure? For example, if they're smokers, drinkers, you know, all of those things that may have an effect that they could personally be involved with that would compound the exposure that they might get in the mines?
Senator Roebling, members of the committee, what you're asking about is something that we're going to be attempting to do in the screening study of former and current workers and their spouses. We'll be asking detailed medical histories on prior work that they have done, hobbies that they've entertained. We'll have detailed smoking information on those people who've been selected to participate. And then we'll also have detailed exposure information on those individuals. So in that setting, we can compare and contrast these different other factors that could be influencing the disease rates. On the cause of death and the case control studies, that information is all based on publicly available information either that's held in the State Health Department or available through the State Health Department's cancer surveillance system. And in that setting, we won't have the opportunity of looking at those other factors in nearly as much detail. We'll have a lot of information on work history and on the exposure aspects of it, but we won't have information on smoking and some of the other factors that we know cause lung disease. Smoking, as it turns out, is not a risk factor for mesothelioma, so we're not too concerned about that particular issue. But we think that this points out the need for us to do these three, have these three different human health studies, because one approach alone just doesn't answer all the questions that that are going to pop up afterwards.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Would you like to bring up your other witnesses?
Other witnesses. If there's no more further questions of these two.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Hang around.
Hey, would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Sue Vento. I'm a resident of Maplewood and a constituent of Senator Wiegers. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to express my support for Senate File 3300 and the great work that Senator Tomasoni is doing to pass important, timely, and much-needed legislation in response to the high incidence of mesothelioma among Iron Range miners. I will long remember with sadness the really tragic news coverage and the deeply emotional testimony during the hearings last year here in St. Paul and in Mountain Iron. And through all of that has come some light in the form of Senate File 3300. I know how to pronounce and spell mesothelioma, not because I'm a spelling bee champion or because I'm a medical practitioner or researcher, but instead because of a very prolonged and personal learning curve I've been on since January of 2000. I'll try to briefly recap my experience with the disease and the lessons I've learned. If you will, I'd like you to please consider the irony of my husband, Bruce Vento, a hardworking junior high science teacher who went on to become a leading national advocate for workers and for the environment, dying from work-related exposure to a natural substance found in the environment. Although he never worked in the mines, his battle with mesothelioma was not unlike that others have experienced, including those miners in northeastern Minnesota. Bruce grew up in a large Italian and German family on St. Paul's East Side, the second oldest of eight children. He learned the importance of hard work at an early age from his parents and from delivering newspapers and busing tables in a hotel restaurant just downtown from here. He worked in factories and a brewery in order to finance his college education to become a science teacher. And actually, those factories and breweries were located just a few blocks to the east of us. At 30, he was elected to the Minnesota House, and 6 years later, he was elected to his first of 12 terms in the U.S. House, where he served on the Natural Resources and Banking Committees. Regardless of where he was, Bruce would typically start each day with exercise, bicycling on the Gateway Trail, swimming, or working out on the Nautilus. In mid-January 2000, he was on a congressional trip. Early in the trip, he mentioned in one of our evening phone calls that he wasn't feeling well. He was noting a shortness of breath and back pain. Immediately upon returning, he went to the house physician and was then taken to Bethesda Naval Hospital for tests. The following day, Bruce was told that he had lung cancer. He flew home that evening, and we spent the weekend talking about how best to proceed. He decided he would go to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. There, we were introduced to the term mesothelioma. Arrangements were made for further testing, and on the morning of January 29th, we were told that Bruce did not have lung cancer, but instead he was diagnosed with mesothelioma. We thought that was good news. The diagnosis was puzzling. Bruce racked his brain to determine where he could have been exposed to asbestos. He later recalled those jobs at the factories and the brewery during the 60s. His exposure to asbestos was no more significant than that which many Americans have experienced in their work and home settings. On Valentine's Day, surgeons removed Bruce's right lung, the lining of the lung, half of the diaphragm, and lymph nodes. At the end of March, he began chemotherapy followed by 6 weeks of radiation therapy. Physicians, nurses, technicians, and staff quickly came to understand that Bruce was not their typical patient. With his science background, he was quick to question them in detail about procedures, medications, and side effects. Even when in wrenching pain or thoroughly exhausted, he'd quiz them before he'd let them proceed. For family and friends, but most especially for Bruce, 2000 was a year focused on his well-being and doing everything he could to beat the disease. The mantra was, if anybody can beat this, Bruce can. Due to his tireless tenacity, his passion, and due to his otherwise good health. Following completion of the radiation therapy, we were given the good news by his doctors that the cancer was gone, and we were confident that we were through the worst of it. But within what was just a few short weeks, complications developed, and we were told that the cancer had spread to the other lung. On September 25th, we were urged to arrange for hospice care, which we did the next day. And on the beautiful autumn morning of October 10th, Bruce died at our home just a few miles from here. Since his death, I've had the privilege of becoming involved in advocacy organizations, the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation, which has supported medical research for mesothelioma treatment at the University of Minnesota, and the Committee to Protect Mesothelioma Victims. Here are just a few of the lessons I've learned since 2000. One, mesothelioma is a diffuse tumor of the lining of the lungs, the abdomen, and in some cases, rarely, the heart. Mesothelioma kills approximately 3,000 Americans each year and thousands more worldwide. The average survival for individuals with mesothelioma is only 1 year. In Bruce's case, 8.5 months. 23 million Americans have been occupationally exposed to asbestos over the past 50 years and are now at risk. What is unknown is the significance of secondary exposure, which poses a very real and lethal risk for many. Secondary exposure can occur when a worker unknowingly brings asbestos home on his or her clothing, hair, or skin. And in December, I attended a funeral in Shoreview for a young mom whose exposure was on her dad's lap. He was a carpenter, and he unknowingly brought asbestos home at the end of the workday. And she would sit on her dad's lap as he'd enjoy coffee and read the newspaper. It may be the result of exposure due to remodeling or the disturbance of asbestos in school, office, work, and home settings. Please keep in mind that many, many Americans who never worked directly with asbestos are becoming ill and dying from mesothelioma and other asbestos-related diseases. Bruce wasn't the first person to have been initially told he had lung cancer. Many mesothelioma patients are initially diagnosed with lung cancer. Some never learn that, in fact, that what they're suffering and dying from is instead mesothelioma. Mesothelioma is an orphan disease in medical research communities. Until just a few years ago, there was not even one treatment for mesothelioma approved by the FDA as better than doing nothing at all. Even this approved treatment, which is regarded as the new standard of care, is associated with only a 3-month survival advantage in the majority of cases which are detected in advanced state. Early detection and treatment options are critical, and funding for those early detection and treatment options is so necessary. Senate File 3300 will help unlock the mysteries mesothelioma has posed for too long, and while it will be of great hope and much benefit to the Iron Range miners and their families in northeastern Minnesota, it will also bring hope to patients and other families who have been dealing with this disease. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Vento. Appreciate those comments, and he certainly is missed by a lot of people, St. Paul and the state. Any questions?
Madam Chair, if anyone is interested in more information about mesothelioma, there are a number of really wonderful books, including a book by Dr. Harvey Pass. It's called 100 Questions and Answers About Mesothelioma. And it's written in layman's terms so that patients and families can understand it, and I'd be happy to share this book.
Okay, thank you. Okay, would you like to introduce yourself?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Charlie Olson, and I'm a taconite miner. I've been a taconite miner for 38 years. I'm also a third-generation steel worker. My grandfathers and my father and my father-in-law and all my uncles all worked in the mine. And I guess I'm here today to ask you to help fund this study on mesothelioma, and I don't really think I'm here about me because I'm ending my career. I hope to retire soon, and a lot of the workers I work with are doing the same thing. We're having a big turnover in jobs and workers on the range in the taconite mines, and I think what we really want is to find out why some of us are getting mesothelioma if we have it. We don't know. It takes so long. You know, you could be retired before you get it. But what I'm really concerned about is the younger workers, the ones that are just starting. What can we do? What should we do to protect them? This study is 3 to 5 years. That's 3 to 5 years that somebody that's starting at the mines today might contact it and might have it and bring it home to their family. So the previous studies that we've had, I think there was two of them, they were never completed. We need to complete these studies to find out what the dangers are, what personal protection of equipment we need to use there, you know, to keep ourselves safe and our families safe. So I think that's just about what I wanted to do, is just come in and ask you guys to help fund this study and make sure that it's completed and that we do it all at one time, so that my children, grandchildren, and the families of the co-workers that I've worked with all my life are safe and don't have to worry about it. I work at Hibbing Taconite, which is on the west end of the range, and I was always told that you don't have to worry about mesothelioma because it's a different kind of rock and it grinds differently, and you don't have to worry about it. But mesothelioma is in all the mines. It's we have cases in every one of them. So thank you for your time.
Any questions for Mr. Olson? Okay. Thank you both very much. We had a... Yes?
Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Lynch. Sorry. For who?
Madam Chair, just general comment. Thank you, Mrs. Vento and Mr. Olson, for coming today. I attended the hearing in Mountain Iron, and it was a standing room only crowd. And during the hearing, many people spoke about their personal experiences. But what really stayed with me the most was the testimony from a very aged man who came forward, and he was frail. And he said to us in a very soft voice that he went to the doctor and he had spots on his lungs. And he looked at us and he said, "And you can't help me. But that's not why I came today. I came today for the next generation. I came today for the ongoing industry." And so while I would say that certainly this study will help one particular jurisdiction in the state of Minnesota, I think it's really much larger than that. And at a time when I think there's some significant economic development opportunities in that area, this is certainly timely. When I came home from that hearing, in fact, while I was at the hearing, someone said in the back of the room, they said, do you remember this? They said, "Senator Lynch, they say you're from Rochester. Why would you care?" And it was at that point that I made a commitment that we would come back and we would work on this and we would make sure that this kind of situation with jurisdiction under the Department of Health would never, ever happen again. So I am happy to support this legislation today and pleased that we are able to move forward. And we're going to be receiving annual reports to the legislature during the coming years so that we can be continually updated on the progress that the university is making. So I look forward to those reports.
Thank you, and we're very pleased to have all the partners that are involved put together a great group, a lot of expertise in that group. Mr. Dave Dedericks from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce wanted to comment. We have two people.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dave Dedericks with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I'll be very brief. We do not have problems with this bill, but we have problems with the money coming out of the Workers' Compensation Special Fund. We're concerned about taking this money out of the fund and also the precedent that this may establish. And so with that, I will conclude my remarks.
And introduce yourself for the committee.
Yes, Madam Chair, John Rakowski with the Department of Labor and Industry. And as this bill has been moving forward through the committees in the House and Senate, our department, which has statutory jurisdiction of the Special Comp Fund, we've been watching this bill with some great concern. Again, not because the study isn't needed. That's not what I'm here to testify on. But since this is a finance committee, I would like to provide some information on the Special Comp Fund and what it does, if I can maybe take 60 seconds or so. Some
please,
of you,
please do.
Thank you. The fund is assessed to all Minnesota employers. So this $4.9 million will result in an increased assessment starting this summer by the commissioner on all state employers. That's the first thing I want everybody on the committee to understand. Secondly, when money is used on the fund is annually assessed by the commissioner, and it's based on actuarials on how many people are currently getting supplemental benefits or what's called second injury benefits. So these people have been in the system and will continue to be in the system for a long time. I believe they say this assessment's going to go away in about 40 years. So the actuarials here are quite lengthy. And the money that's assessed every year is for that snapshot in time for injured workers' payments, also to fund the workers' comp division, which at our department also funds the Office of Administrative Hearings that deals with workers' comp benefit disputes. And I believe it also funds part of the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals, if I'm not mistaken. So it's essentially the department's operating money you're looking at, as well as dollars that go out for state worker payments as well as injured worker payments. So I want you to be cognizant of that. And that's really all I have to say about what the effect of the fund's going to be.
Mr. Rakowski, there's not a surplus in the fund?
Oh, thank you for bringing that up. I wouldn't characterize it as a surplus. I would consider it the cash balance that's remaining for the fiscal year.
And how much is that cash balance?
I believe
over $25 million, Madam Chair. And in 2013, there will still be over $11 million in the fund. So there's a substantial amount.
In
2013, there will still be over $11 million in the fund. So there's a substantial amount of money.
So that's taking into account all the extra people in unemployment because of all the layoffs and everything.
And Madam Chair, it's also an appropriate fund because of the fact that it's about injured workers and about workers' health. And so I think it's probably the right, especially during a period of time when we're in a deficit situation and there is no general fund available for this type of work.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Mr.
He just reminded me, the chairman reminded me that the governor does support this study, and I think he has obviously said that publicly. In his budget is $2 million from the general fund and $2 million from the Iron Range Resources Environmental Trust Fund, which, Mr. Chairman, if I'm getting the name wrong, I apologize.
It's one of our operating
funds. It's one of their operating funds. And part of the purposes of that fund is for worker environmental health and safety. So this is included in the governor's budget.
Senator Tomasoni, I know why you're not going to the general fund. What's the other fund that Mr. Rakowski was talking about?
Madam Chair,
the IRRB.
It's the IRRB, and the IRRB is basically our property tax money on the Iron Range that we use for funding things like public works and other things on the Iron Range. And so I don't think it's the appropriate place to be doing this kind of a funding source.
Okay. Yes, Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Find the right microphone here. Would you talk again about the additional assessment that you think is going to be occurring as a result of this to, did you just say to state employers?
Mr. Rakowski.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, that's correct. The assessment is on all all state employers. And the money is used for those workers who find themselves injured on the job and their employer is not carrying work comp insurance. So it's the beneficiary of last resort, essentially, what this fund is for. And that's all employers, self-insurers, and those who buy insurance on the open market. And I'm anticipating your next question. I don't have the answer to that, what the actual, if this were to take place and signed by the governor, what the assessed increase would be. I don't have the answer to that, but I should have it later today for budget hearings.
Well, Mr. Rakusky, it wasn't clear to me if there would be an assessment or if you could use the cash balance. Who makes that determination?
Well, this legislation would use the cash balance, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. and the commissioner can't do anything in statute until, I believe, the notice goes out starting next week to employers that it's time for an annual assessment, and the assessment is paid by the employers, I believe, in August. So the increase would be in the next fiscal year. Would that answer your question?
No. Why is it a given that there would be an increase and not just use the cash balance that's in the account?
The cash balance, as I testified earlier, is money that's going out for a week for benefits to injured workers every week. It goes to pay for the state workers who work at the department and the workers who work at the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Okay.
So it's essentially encumbered, Madam Chair. But this whole issue about surplus and this issue is just has come up in the last few weeks, and I do have our research people getting me more detailed information.
Okay.
Well, this is the it's going to full finance, isn't
yes.
it, on Friday. So we do have another stop where we could get that information. Senator Michelle.
I don't know if Senator Sharon was done, but I have one.
Are you done, Senator Sharon?
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Your follow-up questions really were helping clarify for me that this is for any employer in the state, not just state employers. It's any employer that you anticipate will be assessed. My follow-up question was yours, if this is a reserve or if this is money that's not utilized, then why would there automatically be an assessment?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I'm taking issue with the fact that there is a surplus. That's what my finance people tell me. They characterize it as a cash balance. It's a cash flow account. It's our operating budget for the commissioner. There used to be a surplus years ago when the commissioner didn't make annual assessments. A surplus built up because the assessment was too high. There's a trend, and I'll be happy to bring that to full finance to show that the assessment has been lowered on employers for the last several years. And I think the chamber can testify to that. So what I'm trying to explain is they try to make sure that the assessment meets expenditures as closely as possible. Mm-hmm. So any change in that is going to affect it, is going to have a tick up in the assessment. And it's based on per $100 of payroll, so that's how I'll characterize it when I get the answer and email it to the full finance committee.
Okay, well, maybe we'll have to wait for further information because it's not, I don't understand how you end up with, if it's more like a cash flow account, how you end up with $25 million. That seems like, for those agencies you mentioned, it didn't seem like they were. That includes all the payments that go out to everyone on unemployment. So it's like
yes.
a cushion?
Madam Workers Chair, come. The annual assessment for 2007 or fiscal year 2008 that we're in was $92 million. And so the $25 million is what's left for the remainder of the fiscal year.
And the assessment, and then what are the biannual expenses? That's a yearly $92 million a year. Then what are the yearly expenses?
Question, I'll get back to you on that.
Okay.
I'm sure in our budget.
I think that's what we're trying to figure out is
yeah.
that is.
And Madam Chair,
once you get beyond all those agencies you mentioned and the payments to workers for unemployment, workers for workers comp, right, is there going to be this $4.9 million available? Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, my understanding is that there not only will be the $4.9 million available, but there will still be a surplus of over $11 million. In 2013, and so
and that's without changing the assessment to businesses.
Yep. That's correct.
I'm sure.
What? You know, yeah, because you know about all this stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Could you pass me the sheet, please? Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, regardless of whether this is a surplus or a snapshot or a cash flow. Question for Senator Tomasoni. Have we ever used this fund to fund a higher education study?
on health care.
Senator Thomasoni.
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, I'm not sure of the answer to that question. I think this fund has been used for other things, though, hasn't it?
Madam Chair, last year, the nurses came forward with a program that tapped into this fund for nursing homes and hospitals that had didn't have the financial wherewithal to buy patient lift equipment. And the nurses came to the Workers' Comp Advisory Council, which is made up of half employers and half employee representatives, seeking their approval of $2 million for a year for this grant program, for this lift equipment. They were denied that, and they went ahead over the Work Comp Advisory Council's objections and were successful in convincing the legislature to finance it at, I believe, $1 million for the biennium. And Senator Thomasoni and I were in intense negotiations on that. I'd say that's fair. And the governor vetoed the second-year appropriation. He allowed the $500,000 to go forward this year, and we spent that money. So put that in perspective, this would be 10 times more of the amount.
Mr. Rakuski, has the Workers' Comp Advisory Council weighed in on this?
No, they haven't, Madam Chair.
Any other questions, Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Thomasoni, you said that the IRRRB fund is used to buy down property taxes, but is that set in the law, or is that just set as a policy of the IRRRB board?
The money that is
Senator
used,
Thomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling. The money that is used in the IRRRB is money that is coming from the mining industry as a result of the production tax that is charged to the mining company in lieu of property taxes. And I don't think it's the appropriate place to do it. If, in fact, you wanted to assess the mining companies, if you thought that was a good idea to assess the mining companies to pay for the study, that would be another thing that you might want to talk about, because in some way you could potentially indicate that the mining companies might have some kind of responsibility here, but the funding source at the IRRRB, I don't believe, is the correct source, and I think that the fact that the Workers' Compensation Special Fund deals with workers' health and with workers' injuries, that this is probably a very appropriate source for it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I guess I would think it would be more appropriate to assess the mining companies instead of all the businesses in the state. I mean, if all the businesses in the state end up paying for this, I don't know that that's fair compared to having the ones who are benefiting from the mining, pay for it. It would seem to me that it would be more appropriate to have the ones who are benefiting from the workers working there and taking the risk to pay for it.
Well, Madam Chair, I think if you wanted to carry that, they'd probably talk to you about it and let you know what they think. But I don't know that we have an automatic escalator in law that increases the production tax, provided we don't stop it. It was their idea, and I'm not sure if that's going to go into effect this year or not. But you may want to have a discussion with the mining companies and see what they think about it.
I will.
Any other questions? Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Thomasoni or any of your witnesses, and maybe a little bit to Senator Rowling's question as well. But as I look at the bill, I don't see anything in here that limits a bill to minors or mesothelioma. It looks like it's on lung health, and lung health could cover everything. Oh, gracious. Everything from secondary cigarette smoke to silicosis to bacterial pathogens to fungal pathogens to particulates to any number of contaminants which would affect lung health. And so I guess my first question is this a lung health study, or is this it points out on line 118 that it talks about industry specific, which seems to me to then entail virtually every industry in Minnesota of any type that might have air contaminants to which people might be breathing. So my first question is this an all-inclusive study that would cover any kind of contaminant that would be known to be detrimental to the lung?
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, I'll bring the university back up here. I think we answered this question already.
Okay, and I apologize. I was late.
But I'll let him take another shot at it.
Professor Mantel and Gene Finnegan.
Members of the committee, the concentrated research effort that we have in mind is really to address health issues in the taconite industry. There is the advantages of looking at a specific industry is that we have a lot of information on exposure in that industry that we can incorporate into these studies. So it wasn't our intent to look at a broad scope of industries across the state. It was specifically to address taconite workers. And we feel that that's the most appropriate way of trying to assess these mesothelioma cases in terms of what those really are all about. Because the exposures in the workplace are far and away the most significant. So that's the whole point, I guess, of focusing the studies within that industry, because we have exposure information. The exposures there are higher than they'll be anywhere else. And if they're going to be problems, that's where we're going to see them, and we can identify them in that setting.
Madam Chair and Professor, that said, I just don't see anything in the bill itself that limits itself to minors and asbestosis or mesothelioma. And maybe it doesn't need to, but it does seem fairly wide open to me, looking at virtually all industries and anything that would affect lung health.
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, the university is definitely keying in on the mining industry and I don't think they have any intention of doing it anywhere else unless their studies lead them somewhere else, I would think. But I know the whole idea is to get to the bottom of this and why there's an inordinate number of occurrences within the taconite industry itself.
Senator Thomas, I would fully support what you're after here. I'm not sure the bill limits it in any way, and if that's important, why we ought to talk about it.
Senator Tomasoni, I have staff looking at that, but is there any reason why you wouldn't want to be more specific that it's a study of in the mining industry of workers' health or
that's
the taconite industry of workers' health?
It's fine by me.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Mr. Fuller will work on that. And then we also wondered on line 122 if we wanted to be more specific than just the year 2013. Going to say December 31st, 2013, or begin studies in 2008? Did you want a more specific date in there? Is that make more sense?
I think studies. This is effective immediately following enactment, so I think that's okay in 2008. But if we want to do December 31 on 2013, that's fine too.
And Dean Finnegan, did you have a date when you're planning on starting the study? Or you didn't want to be too specific because you're not sure?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in fact, we've already
started
the study with the preliminary work that we've been doing.
Okay.
So as soon as the authorization occurs, we are ready to push into the next phase.
All right.
Yes.
Okay. Are you ready? Okay, Mr. Fuller has some suggested language.
Madam Chair, members, on line 1.10, in the line there, cross delete the word study of, and then delete everything down to on line 11 to comprehensive. So we read the appropriation must be used for a comprehensive science and evidence-based study of.
And now's my question. Do you want taconite mining industry workers or mining industry workers? Lung health. Which would you prefer?
Taconite mining industry is fine.
Okay. So it would be for a comprehensive science and evidence-based study of taconite mining industry workers' lung health.
move that or can I incorporate it?
Why don't you move it?
Yeah, I'll move that, Madam Chair.
Okay, does everyone have the amendment? The appropriation must be used for a comprehensive science and evidence-based study of taconite mining industries, workers' lung health. It's a little long, but okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. That was moved by Senator Tomassoni.
And, Madam Chair, then, do we need to insert on line 122, December 31st, after than and before 2013?
Okay, Senator Tomassoni moves on line 122 before 2013 to insert December 31st. Okay, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Chair, if there's no further comments or questions, now the appropriate motion to move it to finance with the intention of sending it to the floor, or
that's fine,
Madam Chair.
Senator Clark.
Yeah, sorry, I do have another question. Madam Chair and Senator Tomassoni, I'm wondering, with the scope being narrowed, if that will impact the fiscal note or if it remains the same.
Right, Madam Chair and Senator
Clark,
Tomassoni. The intent all along was to do that anyway, so I don't think it'll have any I don't have any change, but I would have you.
Okay. Okay, Senator Tomassoni.
So, Madam Chair, I'll move that Senate file 3300 as amended be recommended to pass, be referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention of sending it to the floor.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, committee members.
Looked at you.
I was ready to say no on the phone.
I don't.
I'm coughing.
I can find two.
This is not bronchitis. This is just phlegm
in my throat. Senator Sharon. Anything about
Michelle? The employers who
benefit. Specifically. Senator Sharon, do you want to take a paper?
What?
It's my turn.
No, I don't.
Go ahead. You know, that's what he said about us. Budget's tight. Senator Sharon, Senate File 3795.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. I have a delete all amendment, the A2 amendment that should be being distributed, that I'd like to offer to place the bill in the form that I intended.
Okay, Senator Sharon moves the A2 amendment. As a author's amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is in front of us.
Thank you very much. Chair Pappas and members of the committee, this is a bill that was introduced by the encouragement of the Minnesota State University Student Association. And it's had some modifications and changes along the way, but the essence of the bill is to address the budget deficit this year, and to make a statement as to what the legislature's intent would be in terms of how to address the budget crisis and the budget shortfall as it relates to higher education. And in the first paragraph of this A2 amendment, what you will notice is that the language indicates that the legislature is directing the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities to allocate reductions to the activities of the chancellor that do not have a direct effect on instructional services to students and that do not result in reductions to the amounts distributed to the individual campuses. The legislature, if this is passed, is encouraging the Board of Trustees to review the implementation schedule for technology and infrastructure initiatives to identify activities that can be delayed without affecting direct instructional services. The second paragraph talks about the intent of the legislator in limiting the amount of appropriation reductions to the state colleges and university system intended to continue to support the limit to tuition increases to 2% at community colleges and 3% at the state universities. The legislature furthermore supports the ongoing position of the legislature that indicates that we have a significant portion of higher education funded by the state as opposed to the portion paid for by the students. That's the essence of this bill, and I have with me students representing student organizations that would like to speak to this bill as well.
Great. Thank you, Senator Sharon, and welcome, Mr. Allen, Mr. Formo.
For the record, my name is Graham Allen, and I am the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota State University Student Association. Madam Chair, Senators, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today regarding Senate File 3795. As you all know, the percent of funding from the state to cover costs associated with public higher education institutions has declined dramatically in the past 5 years. Budget cuts in the past few years have contributed to a 54% increase in tuition on average at our state universities and colleges. That's pretty considerable in a very short amount of time. This has propelled the cost of public higher education in Minnesota to be one of the highest in the nation. The bill before you today reaffirms that the legislature would like to get back to funding 67% of the cost of attendance. This is an issue of investing in our educational institutions, Minnesota students, and the workforce of tomorrow. I'll make my comments pretty brief. One slight correction, I'd like to thank MSCSA for coming forward with this bill. It was actually originally their bill they came for, and we have been helping them get this passed and heard. So just a quick correction. We can't thank you enough, Madam Chair, for and especially thank Senator Sharon. Both our student associations approached Senator Sharon to author this bill. She has worked with us in a very short time period to craft this bill, and we can't thank her enough for helping promote this and for allowing us to come in today to talk about the issues of tuition and state funding for higher education. If this bill does make its way into the higher education budget omnibus bill, we're looking forward to working with the conference committee members to work on language and try to get something that helps reaffirm the state's long-term commitment to getting back to funding 67% of the cost of higher education. And with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Formo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Scott Formo, President of the Minnesota State College Student Association. I, too, would like to thank Senator Sharon and Chair Pappas and the rest of the committee for allowing us the opportunity to speak on Senate File 3795. To make my comments very brief, I would echo the majority of what Graham Allen has said or Mr. Allen has already said. We do feel that the last round of budget cuts was one that was tough on students, and trying to take some time to reaffirm that commitment by the state and work over that over the next few years to get back to that 67% commitment is the real intention behind bringing this forward to you for consideration, and we thank you for considering that, and we too look forward to ironing out the details in conference committee if this makes it into your bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. I just want to really affirm what the students are communicating to us about what their needs are. And I just would draw your attention to the fact that the appropriations that we allocated to the campuses via the campus allocation formula in the MNSCU 2009 budget are about $559,371,000 compared to a much smaller number than that in 2003. So the actual number allocated to the campuses is smaller now than it was back in 2003. And that's occurred despite growth and substantial inflation. The campuses are getting less appropriation allocations than it did 6 years ago. Now, this is a tough time, and we aren't happy about the fact that we have to make any kind of reductions in our allocations to the campuses. But what we're talking about here is that in this tough time, that that we are giving a clear message that we believe that this time, in this this fiscal year, that we need to make certain that the reductions are preferably occurring in the central office. This year, Minsky received a 10.6% increase in the appropriations from the legislature, but the amount that was passed on to the campuses via the allocation formula was only about 3.5%. So, meanwhile, the whole system set-asides were about 45%, mostly due to a 115% increase in the system's level of technology spending. So that is the basis and the understanding of sort of reasonable ideas and planning that's going on at the Minsky level. But with the difficulties that are occurring in our ability to make allocations this year, we are proposing with the students to send a message about where that needs to be resolved.
Yes, Mr. Allen.
Just one quick comment. We definitely want to work with the Board of Trustees and the Office of Chancellor trying to find if there are going to be cuts, and obviously we don't want to see any cuts, but if there are cuts that go through because of the budget problem in this state.
We'll find out in a few minutes.
We want to work with the Board of Trustees and the Office of the Chancellor to try to find ways to help minimize the impact and try to find good strategies and you know, cost conscious and resource conscious, and we would like to work with them to find the best approach for any potential cuts that may come.
Great. Thank you. Any questions from the committee on this language? The intention is that this be incorporated into our division supplemental budget proposal.
Yes.
Senator Latz.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just a little concerned. I share the priority. I'm a little concerned about us stating that in reference to any kind of a tuition cap. I mean, we've had discussions before about caps on tuition, and this is just a hair short of that. We're not going to cap your tuition, but don't you dare go above 3%, or you'll be violating the trust that the legislature is putting in you by the appropriations we're giving. And I certainly respect the intent, and I'm pained by the fact that higher ed systems end up being a target because they do have other resources to turn to, namely tuition. I mean, that's why I think disproportionately higher ed systems have been targeted for budget cuts in the past. I'm a little concerned about this being sort of micromanaging Minsky. I'm not sure that's a path that we necessarily want to go down. Other than other instances where we've done it, they're concerned about taking this step.
And there have been discussions, Senator Lance, with representatives from Minsky about what the board intention is, so we're not operating in a vacuum here. They certainly, if someone is here, could speak for themselves, but you know, I just was informed that the board is feels like if the the $5 million cut in the bill, I've given it away, that they feel that it would not be necessary for them to raise tuition. If it goes above that, then it may be more difficult for them. So I think in conference committee, if the cut does end up going above that, we might have to revisit this. But for now, I share your concerns of not directing Minsky. This is session language. It's not in statute. So it's just kind of for now. It's not permanent. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Senator Sharon and students, for bringing this to us. And I think it is appropriate that we suggest that cuts be made in other places as far away from the students as possible. And I think that too often it's been too easy to turn to the tuition and say, well, we're not getting it where we, you know, from our other sources, so we're going to turn to the students and get the money. And businesses, you know, businesses sometimes operate that way when they can't, you know, when they have to raise more revenue, they sometimes raise their product costs, but oftentimes they look internally first because they know it's a competitive market. They have to compete. Their product costs can't continue to increase. But for some reason, our colleges and universities did a 50% tuition increase in recent years. And I just think that it's been too easy for them to turn to the students instead of looking inside at what else they might be able to change within their own systems in order to reduce costs. And so I would not mind at all putting a cap on here for a few years and forcing them to look internally at what else can be done before they raise tuition.
Senator Letts. Senator Roebling, that is really is a good question. And I think that we did have a number from them about, in terms of the cuts we did in 2003, how much of that they made up with tuition increases and how much of it was internal cuts. But that was, it was only one session that we did that big cut, because then the next session we came in and did an 8% increase. And then last year, I thought it was more like a 12% increase, Senator Sharon. So, you know, we're trying to, you know, if they backfilled the cut with tuition, they shouldn't have to do that anymore if we're giving them increases. Unless there's some kind of out-of-control expenses like healthcare, you know, that is driving the agenda, or certainly the chancellor's desire and IFO's desire to bring the salaries up of the faculty at the four-year colleges so they're more in keeping with what the national average is. You know, there's that goal. So there are some other things there.
Technology.
The cost of technology. It's a huge cost to redo all their technology. Right. We saw that. We're seeing that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Letts.
We're discussing this within a box, within a frame that has been set for us. And we should recognize that, too. There are alternatives to trying to force cuts into administration and avoid tuition increases. But we've been set this frame of working within a zero-sum budget in order to accomplish this. So we should recognize that as a predicate for this entire discussion.
Good comment. Yes, Mr. Formal.
Madam Chair, committee members, if I just may make one more comment. We've worked very closely with the Office of the Chancellor and the Board of Trustees this year, and when we first introduced the concept of this bill, it was a much easier with the language because of the fact that at that particular time, that was under the assumption that there were no cuts to the system, and the board had been working last fall with trying to reduce tuition on their own. We fully support, you know, the board's initiatives, but a lot of that is going to depend on the final cuts, which does make the language here very difficult and very tricky to accomplish the original intention without knowing how that will affect the system. So, you know, one of the things that we've prioritized is continuing to try to work with the Office of the Chancellor and the board to get to that end result, but knowing how – but because of the fact that the end result of the budget cut is unknown to the board yet. They did have to postpone setting tuition until their next meeting, which will be in May, and after the legislature adjourns, which does make the language in this a little bit more difficult and a little trickier to try to accomplish the end result without necessarily getting into situations that you don't want to be in and we would prefer not to be in, or Minsky also.
Okay. Any other questions? Anyone else want to testify? Then Senator Sharon.
I move the bill be
as amended.
As amended would be included in the overall omnibus bill.
Senator Sharon moves that 3795 as amended be incorporated into the division supplemental budget proposal that will be before us shortly. Okay, any questions, comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Okay. I think we have before us, passed out already, is the budget sheet. And so I'd like to ask Mr. Albrecht to just walk us through the budget sheet.
Madam Chair and members, you'll notice that the sheet in front of you is color-coded, so to speak. The yellow columns highlight the changes for the current biennium, and the green columns highlight the changes for the 2010-11 biennium. To best explain exactly what is in the budget bill, I'm going to go down the from the right-hand side, the second yellow column in that says Senate minus forecast for 2008-2009. And then next to that, if you're interested in seeing how the Senate numbers compare to the governor, that is in the next yellow column to the right. And I'm only going to talk about the places where the amounts change. Obviously, all of those zeros mean that the amount that was appropriated last year remains the same in the current Senate proposal. And the first change is, looking at the line numbers on the left-hand side of the page, is on line number 14, and that's an operating budget reduction for the Office of Higher Education. It's a 4% reduction, and the amount of that is $111,000.
And if I can occasionally interrupt, as I help myself read this budget page, the reason that the column, the yellow column to the right, is zero is because this is the same as the governor. There's no change. The governor's recommendations are the third column in white from the left, if you want to see the governor's recommendations, correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair. The next change is on line 19. That is a cancellation of an appropriation that was made in 2005 to the Office of Higher Education to rewrite the software for the state grant program. And in discussions with the Office of Higher Education, we discovered that they would not be spending that $90,000. The next series
if we have any questions on any of these items, feel free to speak up.
The next series of changes are in the state grant program. They begin on line 35, which just shows that for everybody, the governor and the legislature, the beginning place to start allocating additional money in the state grant program is to work with this $15 million that has become available because of changes in the federal Pell Grant program. Basically, the federal government increased the Pell Grant program, and then that has the effect of reducing state grant awards in the state, which makes this amount of money available to reallocate within the program. The first Senate change is on line 36. That's reducing the student share from 46% to 45%.
This was in Senator Scoy's bill, so it was his recommendation, and it came from the Private College Council as well.
And the student share is the portion of the budget to attend a college that is allocated to the student within the state grant formula. On line 37 is not a Senate position, but that was the governor's proposal to increase the LME component of the formula by 3%.
And I'm not recommending that in this budget because we've been doing quite a bit with LME because that's our mechanism we use if we develop a surplus. So we hadn't really done anything on student share for a while. I thought we should maybe try that instead of LME.
And going back, members, to line 36, the cost of doing that change in the student share is $7.25 million. Moving ahead to line 38, that reflects an increase in the four-year tuition maximum. It's a 3% increase. The tuition maximum would become $10,133, which is slightly below the tuition used by the Office of Higher Education for attending the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus.
This was in the governor's recommendation and in Senator Scoy's bill, although this is the governor's level. We couldn't afford to do Senator Scoy's level.
Moving ahead to line 39, is a reduction in the assigned family responsibility. That is a mechanism within the state grant program that adjust the amount that families are expected to pay of the overall education budget for a student or for themselves if they happen to be the student?
This was in the governor's proposal, and the Office of Higher Education tells us that this in particular does help the independent students and the part-time students, which have a, you know, are at a disadvantage with the state grant.
And members, the cost of that proposal is $4.51 million. On line 40 is Senator Coring's bill that changed the definition of a resident student to include the spouse of a veteran. The cost of that is $16,000.
And since Senator Coring isn't here and this is such an expensive program, I'm going to move to delete it. We'll see if that gets his attention. He comes in here.
Moving on to line 41, there is an amount unallocated both in the governor's proposal and in the Senate position. The Senate leaves about $1.6 million unallocated, and the reason for doing that is because there's some degree of uncertainty in whether or not $15 million is a very precise number.
I know Linda does that kind of.
Moving on to page 2 and going to line 49, the Senate position eliminates the Achieve scholarship proposal, the portion of that funding that was passed last year that actually would pay for the individual scholarships. It leaves in place the money that was appropriated in fiscal year 2008 for related purposes of tutoring and making more rigorous courses available to certain areas in the state.
Well, and I know some, this is still a controversial program, and just in the interests of full disclosure, this has been a dialogue between Senator Cohen and myself, and I did recommend that we just eliminate the first year and delay the program a year, but Senator Cohen decided to take the money in the base, the future. So.
Moving on to line 52, this is another reduction that was arrived at in discussions with the Office of Higher Education. It is an ongoing reduction of $250,000 in the appropriation for the tuition reciprocity payments. They appear to be confident that they can meet the state's obligations with $250,000 per year less. There is general authority for them to transfer amounts within appropriations if that ends up not being the case. The same is true for the amount on line 53 for the Minnesota College Savings Program, also a $250,000 ongoing reduction.
I would really like to take a look at that program to see why we're running surpluses there. Maybe we need to do some more publicity or something to get more parents to sign up for it. So it'd be helpful if the Office of Higher Education could kind of help me look at that.
On lines 64 and 65 are amounts that are transferred from the Special Revenue Fund. There's a surplus in the private institutions regulation account, and an amount that's $100,000, and there's an amount that was authorized in last year's state government bill for state agencies to spend some amount of money on one-time technology needs. And in talking with the Office of Higher Education, that $18,000 is money that they don't have plans to spend, and they have to spend it in 2008, otherwise they don't get to it.
This is really called nickel and diming.
Moving down on, still on page 2, to lines 81 through 83, these are the changes for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. the Senate's proposed operating budget reduction is $6.5 million, and then there is a $1 million and a $500,000 appropriation. The first one on line 82 directs money to campuses that have experienced a reduction in reciprocity tuition that resulted from a decision by the state of Wisconsin that the legislature's ending of non-resident tuition at specific colleges meant that their students didn't have to pay the reciprocity rate. And on lane 83 is an amount also going to the campuses, $500,000, to a series of campuses that are described in the bill that after the legislature eliminated non-resident tuition for a certain list of campuses last year, these campuses went ahead and eliminated it also, and this would compensate them, basically making their budgets whole for taking that action.
Well, it would compensate them in the second year, but I think they still take a loss in the first year.
Madam Chair, I think that the amount of $500,000 is a biennial amount and doesn't distinguish between the 2 years, but we might want to confirm that okay. with the system.
Madam Chair?
Senator Michelle.
On that, so this was a group of schools that had gone ahead without a state appropriation to do what
right.
some schools that did get a state appropriation from us last year.
Senator Michelle, it's kind of was a problem that resulted with quick decisions that were made during a conference committee. You know, the Senate came up with, I think, a full $16 million to compensate all the two-year colleges for them going to resident tuition. In the conference committee, there wasn't that much money available. It was half or less than half. So, you know, I kind of consulted with staff from MNSCU. We very quickly picked a list of colleges. And what we did is some colleges were at a competitive disadvantage then because they were going to lose students because they weren't able to offer the resident rate. So they just decided in order to stay competitive that they would just bite the bullet and go on their own. And I really felt like it was kind of an unintended consequence of a very quick decision that was made with not a lot of thought, which happens in conference committees. And so I felt bad. And so I...
Your conference committees, apparently.
My conference committee. Oh, Senator Cohen, I didn't...
Never in mind.
Did you hear my earlier comment about you? Maybe that's why you're here. So, and then the reciprocity thing was also another unintended consequence, that Wisconsin would look at the compact as a higher authority and some language in the compact that nobody remembered, rather than the state law, which said this should not impact reciprocity agreements. So these problems were created for these campuses, and I thought it was fair then to come up with the money to make them whole.
Hey, Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
Just another comment on what you've done, or what you're recommending to the full committee. Obviously, none of us are pleased with a cut of a dollar to higher education, and you're certainly recommending some cuts to the systems, and obviously they've talked to us about the possibility of having to raise tuition to compensate for this as a possibility. But you also are making sure that there is the additional money in the grant and loan program, which hopefully might balance that off.
Okay. Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair and members, this is probably a good point to point out some of the oddities of dealing with negative numbers. On line 86, if you look at the comparisons of the Senate position to the governor, the totals are positive numbers. And the way to interpret that in this instance is that the governor's position includes $21.6 million more in cuts in 2008-2009 and $43.2 million in 2010 and 2011. And you don't run into quite the same problem in the Senate position of showing that the overall change in 2008-2009 is $5 million and $10 million in 10 and 11. And that's just because you're not subtracting two negative numbers in the Senate's case. Moving on to page 3, the changes for the University of Minnesota are reflected on lines 100 through 102. Beginning with the operating budget reduction, in the case of the Senate, it's $15.5 million. If you notice that the amount for 2010-11 is $10 million, which shows you that that's $5 million a year. So $10 million of that $15 million for 2008-2009 is a one-time reduction. It's a long way of getting to that fact. On line 101 is $500,000. That's an appropriation for a couple of healthcare modeling projects that are in the bill. And on line 102, that is there showing that the Senate does not include the money for the minors' health study in the higher education bill, but the governor did have that amount as part of his higher education proposals. And then finally, the overall totals are in two places. On line 109, that's the amount before transfers, $27.7 million. And then on line 116 is showing the effect of transferring that additional $118,000 from the special revenue fund.
Okay. Any questions on the spreadsheet? Senator Cohen.
Another comment. I believe the minors health study will be reflected in Senator Tomasoni's recommendations.
We just passed that bill out, Senator Cohen, to you.
You passed out of here?
Yeah, 3300.
Yeah, but I think we're going to have it financed. Senator Tomasoni.
Senator Cohen, my intent is to put that bill on the floor by itself.
Is that what you want? Okay. Okay. All right, because I thought you would, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, but I thought you wanted it reflected in your division's recommendations.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, I'm trying to keep as much stuff out of my bill as I possibly can. So this might be one of the ones that I think can go on its own.
Okay.
Do you want to go through the language? Do you want Maya to?
I don't know.
Maya, do you want to, Dr. Weidman, do you want to just point out some of the language changes in the bill itself?
Most of the language, and I'm just kind of going through here real quick, are various appropriation reductions. I think there's some language on page 4, starting on line 4.12, directing the Board of Regents to avoid allocating their reductions to programs and activities that would require increased tuition revenue. So I think that is somewhat consistent with the discussion we just had with Senator Sharon's bill. So we continue on 6, 7, and 8, 9.
We're going to have Senator Sharon talk about the global modeling in a few minutes. That's farther on in the bill, the actual language. But the appropriation is 4.17 and 4.22.
Section 10 is just some language that we had appropriated some money last session for the Teach Grant Program. This just authorizes them to use some of that money for administrative costs.
And we passed that in the committee. And then also on 6.13, Subdivision 9, Section 9, this was also a provision that we'd already adopted in the committee.
And the 6.13 basically makes permanent using the budget surplus to reduce LME.
Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Albrecht.
Instead of, you might want to go back to page 5 because Section 7 is, wait, is it Section 7? My section seems to have moved around. I'm looking for the change to the safety officers.
Oh, that's not there yet. Okay. Well, actually, I didn't tell Dr. Weidman that she was going to do this, so maybe I'll just do it. So Section 6 really is the state grant change on the assigned family responsibility. Section 7, this is the coring bill that we'd already adopted. Section 8 is the other change in the state grant on assigned student responsibility that was in the SCOI bill. We talked about Section 9 is making the LME as a mechanism to deal with surplus in the state grant permanent by taking out the sunset. She mentioned the TEACH, Section 10, allowing them to use administration money that we'd already adopted. Section 11, that's staff recommendation to hold all the colleges that go to resident-only tuition to that rate. Section 12, what's Section 12? Now someone can help me with this. This is IOE.
That's the state office, state safety officers' benefits.
Okay.
It's a grant program for children of state.
And that was in the department bill.
Right.
Right, and we probably already adopted that.
We did not.
We did not adopt that. This
no,
is new.
This was basically a recommendation from the Office of Higher Education that would allow those dependents to take advantage of this program until the age of 30. If they enter the military up until this point, they were only eligible up, I believe, to the age of 24 to get benefits under this program. Then Section 13 is basically the increasing the cap on line 7.27 for the four-year program.
Right. That was the recommendation from the governor's bill.
Right. Then continuing on page 8, lines 8.28 to 8.29, basically is the language that goes along with the reduction that was done to the Chief Scholarship Program.
Okay.
And then, again, on the next page, this is language that goes along with reductions in the Achieve Scholarship Program. Section 15, again, this is an Office of Higher Ed provision that allows them to transfer unencumbered funds into the Indian Scholarship Appropriation.
This is new language. This was not in their earlier bill.
Right. And the intent of this is apparently there are some students that are currently on the waiting list, and this would allow them to award some scholarships to those students. Section 16 goes all the way over on page 12, lines 12.3 to 12.4. This apparently was a request from the University of Minnesota. They wanted this change in there of increasing from 1% to 2% for the second year. This is the money that was set aside that they only get after they've met 3 out of those 5 performance goals. And then Section 17 and 18 are the language that... reference, and then I'll just finish up with Section 19 is the repealer of the Achieve Scholarship Program.
So, Senator Sharon, this is a bill that's already passed the Health Committee and is on the floor, and what we're doing in our bill is paying for it, though, because it didn't really have a funding mechanism.
That's correct.
But maybe you want to tell us about what the intent is here.
This is a this global modeling and healthcare reform is comes out of the subcommittee, one of the subcommittees of the health care reform work that was done over the summer. This is a request for an appropriation that will allow the University of Minnesota School of Public Health to develop a modeling tool that will be able to assist us in being able to determine the impact of health policy and to be able to demonstrate to us what its impact may be on a number of various components across sectors. It will help us, for example, determine what it is that we're doing in cost savings in one section. It will help us determine whether or not we are, in fact, cost saving or are we cost shifting to another sector. And it also establishes within the context of this first section, I'm referring to section subdivision one, reforming the modeling tool, what the costs, the distribution of costs to individuals and their families, to businesses and government for health care reform policies. The way I visualize this is that we would be asking through the university the development of a computer-based modeling tool that would help us to be able to enter in certain numbers and assumptions and be able to create predictability or outcomes for us for what the expenditures are across all sectors. And it also, in subdivision two, a component of the bill that will measure the impact of the proposed legislation, quantifying cost savings. In the commission, it asks the Commissioner of Human Services, Finance, and Health, in consultation with the chairs, developing recommendations for the governor and the legislature on changes to state budgeting approaches and legislative processes that bridge the traditional budget boundaries, the typical silos that we have, to make recommendations for how to bridge those boundaries. It also, in the last, in lines 14.16 through 14.19, I think is important because it talks about this tool being something that will help us to take a look at something longer than a two-year budgetary cycle. It assists us to take a look at the impacts of healthcare policy over a longer period of time. So we can take a look at the return on our investment projections when we make these shorter-term budgetary decisions. Under Section 18, the first section here, the appropriation for the first section is about developing and modeling the tool.
And this, that's the $200,000?
That's the $200,000, and that request was based on the assumption that has not completely been confirmed yet that we'll be able to find some private money to add to this section. The actual cost of this is given to us by the university, by Dave Knudsen's university, is $300,000. But we're looking to find some private money to pull in. The second section 18 focuses a little different. It looks similar, but it's different in the sense that we will not be able to accomplish section 18 without the first segment. The first segment is the tool. The second section is an actual analysis. Look at various health care form proposals in order to determine those kinds of outcomes that the first part is the modeling tool. Second part actually asks for a specific analysis.
And that's the $300,000.
That's correct.
Any questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It struck me on the financials that the cost of developing the model, let me get my numbers right, the cost of developing the model was less than the cost of the analysis. I don't know. That just struck me as we can make the tool, but when we want to utilize the tool, it was more expensive. It just struck me as odd. But my larger concern is that I think there's some very, very good things in Section 17 on creating this tool, this model. So I think that's really good. Section 18, as Senator Sharon has indicated, talks about, okay, so once we have this tool, what is it that we're expecting the tool to do? And I guess I would just suggest that We can do all of that within the language that's provided in Section 17, in that if you look at lines 13.10, we are using the tool that will assess the impact of proposed health care reforms or major health care-related legislation. So I'm not sure that Section 18, frankly, is necessary or even advisable. And one of my further concerns in that area is on lines 14.25. It's very specific in the analysis that it's calling for. And I'm a little concerned that by the time that this would be enacted, that the information that we're asking for is kind of, frankly, a day late and a dollar short. We will have worked through and discussed at length some of those very tools or initiatives that we're asking this tool to study. By the time the tool is available to us, I think we will have great things to utilize it with, but I'm not sure that it will be the work that was done in this 2008 legislative session. So my suggestion further is that we take a stronger look at Section 17, and if there are, you know, language components in Section 18 that need to be incorporated, you know, maybe we should ask that question, but I would just offer that I think Section 17 can stand on its own.
Senator Sharon. There's three different things I think I need to speak to here. One is the difference in the costs. I am certain that the first segment of this bill will cost at least $300,000. So we have $200,000 in here, remember, because we are looking to get $100,000 of private money. If that doesn't materialize, I might make some requests for modifying that as we move forward. But so there isn't a differential there. The other thing is that when talking this through with those who have been working with the university on this, it's clear that we cannot accomplish Section 18, which is the analysis component of this, on the same $300,000 that we have set aside for the other section. That simply is the design and the development of the tool. And I can't, quite frankly, it's hard for me to believe that $300,000 will be enough to do that. I think that's really very modest when we took a look at this other amount of money that was set aside for the mesothelioma study. So, but that is the number that has been presented to us, that they could probably pull together a global assessment tool for around $300,000. The second component really takes very specific proposals that are in front of the legislature now, whether it's the governor's proposal or the single payer system proposal or the Healthcare Access Commission proposal, and asks for the analysis to be done, to apply that, to let the model apply itself to those proposals. Now, I understand what Senator Lynch is saying, that by the end of this session, some of all of that may fall off the plate. We may not have any of that to do maybe we can work on not getting so specific that we can't, that if that happens, that it doesn't make sense. But I know that these, that, for example, many of these proposals, some of which will pass out of session this year. Some of those recommendations may need further study and analysis. This will be a perfect tool for that, whether it's from the Governor's Transformation Task Force or the Healthcare Access Commission, or is another proposal that many of our legislators are looking at that would like to have an analysis done on those for us to really understand why we are voting up or down a proposal. And so I just want to be clear that we cannot do both of these under Section 1, because Section 1 simply is the development of the tool. It doesn't ask for a specific analysis. Why don't I suggest this, since the time is getting late, is why don't we ask Mr. Fuller to take a look at the language And I know this bill is on the floor, so I assume the university and the School of Public Health has looked at it. It passed the Health Committee, right? But if they want to make any further input into it and then have him run that language by Senator Lynch and Senator Sharon and myself, and we can then make the – I think the Senator Cohen staff did have some concerns about what we might be putting into place here in terms of fiscal notes. So we can have some more conversations with Mr. Mousman. But I would say that we have a couple days here before we go to full finance, since our staff has just kind of looked at this language recently.
Right. I understand from Senator Cohen, too, that there's some language, some issues in the language here that he would like to process a little bit more before we get to Friday. And I'm certainly willing to do that.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, there's also in Section 17, particularly with this modeling tool, I don't see an indication of when this tool will be available to us. And as we are looking at allocating limited resources, I would think that would be something we would want to take a closer look at.
And a completion date, you're referring
completion
to.
Date, yeah. And also, what are the ongoing costs to keep it, the tool kind of running? That's could be another issue as well. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, you bring up a very valid point. It's been made very clear that there is one fiscal allocation that needs to be met in order that we can create this mechanism. But thereafter, each time we are suggesting that we utilize this tool, it makes, you know, it, on the one hand, it seems like this will be wonderful. You plug in your information and it will spit out the report. But I'm not exactly sure if that's really how it will be processed. I think rather it might be, as we're seeing in Section 18, we'd like you to study this, this, and this. And by the way, it's $100,000 for this one and $100,000 for this one. And so I think some of those ongoing sorts of things are also to be considered.
Okay. Senator Sharon.
What the essence of this is about, you know, you're either going to buy it or you're not going to buy it, and that is that we ought to be creating some analysis of the impact of health policy legislation on whether or not it is achieving the outcomes that are expected by the legislation. And this, of all the things that we're talking about, creates an environment in which we're capable of doing that. So there may be an investment, small investment in what we have to do in order to do an analysis before we spend a lot of money moving forward on healthcare proposals that steer us somewhere that may not get us where we want to go. And if we can develop a tool that gives us some ways of predicting and measuring what the outcomes are, I think that's certainly a worthwhile
We don't have
investment.
A lot of objective material. You know, you have kind of different groups claiming you're going to save this amount of money improve health to this extent, and we don't really know if that's if that's true or not. It's not really very research or scientifically based.
And this has to be scientifically based, and it's very specific that we're taking it outside of a governmental entity so that everybody who's as best we can, you know, even when there's scientific data, everybody will argue the validity of the scientific data. But the fact that it will go to the university through that process and be scientific engagement in this process takes away some of that says that the outcome is biased somehow. So we're trying to find something that everybody would be able to feel some comfort level with in terms of doing analysis about the proposals that are coming forward to us.
Okay, Senator Wieger.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, is there anything in here about quality of care?
Senator Sharon.
It could certainly be. I think there's one on the analysis page on line 14.8, measure the impact of proposed legislation on health and well-being. Mm-hmm. You know, all of that requires that we articulate how is that behaviorally measured. So like reductions in childhood obesity might be one. Are the things that we'd be able to measure. Creating all of that language and putting that into a tool is a complicated process that that this is about. And its limitations will be what questions we what we create as the questions. It will be limited by what it is that we design, you know, the limitations of the design of it, what we ask it. And I suppose as we go along, we'll always have more questions that we'd like to add to it in order to be more comprehensive.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Sharon, is this going to be some type of a computer model that
It's a computer-based
model. Program then when a proposal goes before the policy committee or Commerce Committee because of the insurance aspect, this model, which would not have proprietary use by the university exclusively, it would be for our use?
It's ours. It is ours.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Sorry, Senator Pappas. It becomes ours. It's not owned by the university. It's designed by the university, but it's ours. And I don't know if you saw long-term care model that showed what the long-term needs would be on nursing home beds. And it showed how you could lay in a whole set of assumptions, and it would show by county, based on county statistical analysis, what the needs would be. That's how I envision this being. I cannot imagine being able to create this with all the complexity of healthcare reform. But it is that kind of a concept of trying to create a set of questions in a computer-based program that you feed in the data that's presented in a certain healthcare reform policy, and it lays out and answers very specific questions, in particular cost shifting, whether or not there's cost savings or cost shifting.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to comment on anything in the budget document? Anyone who wants to, any amendments? And does someone want to make a motion? Senator Tomasoni moves that Senate Council document